involve yourself with such dangers. I hate to do it, but this cannot go unpunished. Consequences come with a high cost, some more than others.
Chapter 21. The Wretched Truth. Wadsworth Residence, Belgrave Square, 30th September, 1888. The carriage ride home was almost as terrible as bearing witness to one of the mutilated bodies at the double event. I'd rather be on intestine clean-up duty than suffer through the choking silence sitting miserably with us. By the time we pulled up to our home, I was ready to burst out of my skin, simply to escape the anger seeping through my pores. I was furious with Blackburn for conspiring with my father and not having the decency to mention it. But I was seething over my brother most of all. How dare he betray me by leading our father to where I was? He had to know how mad it'd make father, thinking his only daughter was in direct danger. The East End was rife, not only with improper people, but with disease, which spread quickly because of the deplorable living conditions. What's more, it was foolish to drag father to an area known for its opium dens. Every male in my life felt it necessary to put chains on me, and I despised it. Except for Thomas, I realized. He taunted me into acting and thinking for myself. Before I could race up to my room, father called out to me, "A word, please, Audrey Rose." I closed my eyes briefly before turning around. I didn't want to be scolded or hear about how fragile life was or how foolish it was to place oneself in reckless situations, but saw no way out of it. When father had something to say, one listened, and that was that. I drifted away from the stairway and the freedom it provided, heading directly toward the den of lecturing. Aunt Amelia and Liza were out shopping for fabrics to take back to the country with them. Their visit was nearly over, and they'd be leaving first thing in the morning. I was grateful they weren't here to witness my scolding. Aunt Amelia would say the last couple of weeks had done nothing to save either my soul or reputation. She might even suggest a little country air was exactly what I needed. Leaning against the wall in the corridor, Nathaniel still wouldn't meet my glare, enraging me all the more. What a slithering wimp! Father motioned for me to step into the drawing room and have a seat. With no other choice, I did. I settled into a chair, as far away from him as possible, while waiting for my guilty verdict to be delivered and my punishment to be swiftly bestowed. Father was taking his time, however, calling for a tray of tea and biscuits, sorting through mail near the fireplace. If he was trying to ratchet up my anxiety, it was working. My heart thudded wildly against my ribs, begging to be set free with each new letter he tore into. The only sounds in the room came from the crackling fire and rustling of paper on paper. I sincerely doubted my sloshing blood could be heard, but it was a sinister symphony in my own ears nonetheless. I watched the careful way he held the letter opener, the sharp blade piercing the envelopes, before he ripped the letters free with one savage swipe after another. Whenever I scared him, he turned into some foreign person, one who was both frightening and frightened at once. Folding my hands together in my lap, I waited as patiently as I could for him to calm himself enough to speak with me. My dark skirts were an abyss I'd like to sink into. He sealed an envelope, then handed it off to a servant before finally crossing the room.
"I understand you've been sneaking out of the house for some time now. Studying forensic sciences with your uncle, is that right?"
Without asking, he poured a cup of tea, then offered it to me. I shook my head. Too nervous to even dream of eating or drinking when he was so calm and composed. He paused, waiting for an excuse. But I couldn't bring myself to respond. Once an animal's fate had been decided, there was no undoing the crimson necklace they'd wear. It mattered not what I said in my defense. He knew it as plainly as I did. He sat down, crossing one foot over his knee.
"What, pray tell, did you expect me to do upon finding out? Be pleased? Be supportive of you potentially throwing your life away?"
A flicker of rage showed in his chiseled features. He clenched his jaw, then exhaled slowly.
"I cannot allow you to tarnish your reputation by indulging your eccentricities and the debauchery you're involved with. Pleasant people who abide by polite society do not find themselves in your uncle's laboratory. Were your mother still alive, it would kill her to see you involved in such matters.
I picked at the tiny buttons on the side of my gloves, fighting tears with all my might. I was angry with Father for his words, but most of all hated that he might be correct. Perhaps Mother would despise the work I did. From childhood, she was instructed to stay away from dreadful things, owing to her weakened heart. My unbecoming work might very well have broken it, had the fever not done so first. But what of her insistence that I could be both strong and beautiful? Surely Father had to be wrong. Nathaniel moved from the doorway to stand inside the room. I hadn't noticed him still lingering there, but from the stricken expression on his face, knew he'd heard every word. I wanted to muster up a decent scowl, but couldn't find the strength. My heart ached too much.
From this point forward, you shall live according to society's rules, Father continued, satisfied with my obeisance. You'll smile and be charming to every suitor I deem acceptable to court you. There'll be no more talk of science, or of your degenerate uncle.
He moved out of the chair and stood before me so swiftly I couldn't prevent myself from recoiling.
Should I discover your disobedience once more, you shall be turned out on the streets. I'll not tolerate you sniffing around this disturbing case any longer. Have I made myself perfectly clear?
I drew my brows together. I could not comprehend what had just happened. Father had been mad before, angry enough to keep me indoors for weeks on end. But he'd never threatened to toss me into the streets. It went against the very purpose he had for keeping me close all my life. Why bind me to our home, only to throw me from it? I blinked tears back, and kept my attention locked onto the swirling design on the rug. Then slowly nodded. I didn't trust my voice. I refused to sound weak on top of looking the part so well, and knew my voice would crack under the weight of emotion. Father must have been pleased, because his shadow lifted from before me, then disappeared from the room altogether. I listened as his heavy footsteps faded down the hall. When his study door slammed shut, I allowed myself to exhale. A single tear snaked down my cheek and I angrily swiped it away. I'd held it together for this long. I would not break in front of Nathaniel. I would not. Instead of rushing to my side as I expected, Nathaniel stayed planted to his post near the door, craning his neck into the hall. It was hard to tell if he was looking to escape or convincing himself to stay. What did Father promise you for your betrayal? His back stiffened, but he didn't turn around. I stood, moving closer. Must have been extraordinary. Something you couldn't turn down. A new suit? An expensive horse? He shook his head, hands twitching at his sides. Any second and he'd grab the comfort of his comb. Stress never looked good on him. I stalked closer, my tone antagonizing. I wanted him to feel my hurt.
A large estate, then?
The silver comb flashed in the flickering firelight as my brother ran it through his hair. I went to walk by when he whispered, "Wait." His tone gave me pause, my silk shoes straddling the threshold. He sounded no louder than a church mouse squeaking inside a grand cathedral. Moving back into the room, I waited. I'd allow him the courtesy of saying his piece, then be on my way. I plopped onto the chair, exhausted from the day's events, while Nathaniel checked the hallway before closing the door. He paced, as all Wadsworth men were prone to do, agitation or nervousness shrouding him. It was hard to tell which emotion was getting the better of him. Nathaniel crossed the room to the buffet, removing a crystal decanter and matching glass. He poured himself a healthy amount of amber liquid, drinking it down in a few gulps. That was very un-Nathaniel-like. I sat forward. What is it? My brother shook his head, still facing the decanter, and refilled his cup.
I can't begin figuring where to start.
The utter loathing in his tone chilled me. I got the impression we were no longer talking about him telling Father I'd sneaked out of the house this morning. My anger dissipated,
Was something else wrong with Father? I couldn't take another emotional upheaval. There was too much to sort through as it stood. "Most start around the beginning," I said, hoping to keep the fear from my voice and force levity into it. "Tell me what's been troubling you. Please, let me help." Nathaniel stared at the crystal glass in his hand. It seemed easier for him to speak to it, rather than meet my worried gaze.
"Then I'll speak quickly, in hopes of causing you less pain."
He took a sip of liquid courage, then another.
"Mother wasn't the last person operated on by our loving uncle."
I was grateful he paused, allowing me time to absorb the enormity of his words. Everything else in the room stopped, including my heart. This was a subject we were banned from discussing by both uncle and father.
He's been attempting to complete a successful transplant since he and father were young men.
My brother pinched the bridge of his nose.
Father, while dealing with his own demons, reacts in such a way because he knows uncle keeps secrets from you.
Secrets? I know all about uncle's former experiments, I said, sitting straighter in my chair. His attempt at saving mother's life is why I started studying under him in the first place.
Saving her, was he?
Nathaniel gave me a pitying look.
For the good of London, they should have kept him locked away. He's never stopped his experiments, Audrey Rose. He's only gotten better at hiding them.
That's not true. I shook my head. How my brother could think such a thing about Uncle was preposterous. I'd know about any experiments.
I promise you, it is true. I hoped you'd outgrow your desire to apprentice with him and thought it unnecessary to divulge such delicate matters.
Nathaniel took my hands, squeezing gently until I met his eyes.
Just as I do not wish to burden you with too much now, sister. If you need some time.
Oh, I'm more than ready to learn the truth. The entire truth, no matter how horrid it may be. Do enlighten me further and make it quick. He nodded.
Very well, then. The entire truth is this. Your friend, Thomas Cresswell, he...
Nathaniel sat back and took another sip from his drink. I wasn't sure if the pause in the story was for my benefit or his. My stomach tied itself in knots as I waited for the next horror.
Are you sure you're all right? You look a bit peaked.
Please, tell me the rest.
All right, then,
he said, releasing a shaky breath.
Thomas's father came to Uncle after Mother's death. His wife experienced severe abdominal pain around that time. He'd heard rumors of Uncle's research.
Nathaniel swallowed.
Thomas's mother passed away, shortly after ours, of gallbladder issues. Uncle tried saving her life too.
Wonderful. So you're saying Uncle killed Thomas's mother? Nathaniel reached for me, slowly shaking his head.
No, not exactly. Thomas has been obsessed with searching for a true cure ever since. It's all he talks of when the Knights of Whitechapel meet. I can practically conduct the research myself. He's gone into that much detail.
He hasn't mentioned anything to me about it at all. Chills stuck their nails into my back, repeatedly dragging themselves downward. That wasn't entirely true. Thomas had insisted I remove the gallbladder from the cadaver he'd gotten from the necropolis. A memory of the latest crime scene flashed through my mind. I was almost positive a gallbladder had been taken from one of the victims, too. I felt utterly sick to my stomach. Could I have been so blind or so wrong about Thomas? No, I wouldn't accuse him of sadistic murders simply because he was different from other people in our closed-minded society. He was purposely cold and detached working a case, and it was brilliant and necessary. Wasn't it? My head suddenly pounded. Maybe I was making excuses for him. Or perhaps they were excuses he'd deftly planted in my brain. He was certainly cunning enough to do such a thing. But would he? Too many emotions swirled through my head to keep track of. If Thomas experienced the kind of heartache that came with watching as a loved one passed on, then perhaps he might do anything, even murder. to discover answers he'd sought. Then again, didn't I suffer from a similar heartache when Mother died? I supposed it was a decent enough reason for Jack to steal organs. But was Thomas, the arrogantly charming boy I knew outside of the laboratory, truly capable of committing such atrocities in the name of science? I hardly thought he could become that cold and remote. Still, my head spun. The ladies at tea claimed he was odd enough to be the madman, but that was merely idle gossip. I clenched my fists at my sides. I refused to believe my instincts were so wrong about him, even if there was strong evidence to the contrary. Which was the exact notion that got the Ripper's victims murdered. I dropped my head into my hands. Oh, Thomas, how do I sort this mess out too?
Chapter 22. Saucy Jack. Wadsworth Residence, Belgrave Square, 1st October, 1888. Early morning light slanted in from the cathedral windows of our dining room, but I could stare only at the two pieces of evidence scrawled in Jack the Ripper's hand while my breakfast cooled. The days of holding back his ghastly deeds were apparently over. Jack wanted everyone to know he was responsible for these horrendous crimes. He was like an actor or king, soaking up the attention of adoring fans and countrymen. Troubled as I was by Thomas's past, the idea of him being the Ripper didn't sound quite right. The day Thomas Cresswell didn't show off his brilliance was the day I'd find a unicorn for a pet. Jack wanted adoration. Thomas would surely have slipped by now. Then again, he did keep his work with Uncle on transplants secret all these weeks. I cursed my softness toward him. I needed to detach my emotions, but it was proving more difficult than I'd envisioned. I rubbed my temples and read the paper again. I wasn't surprised the serpent side of Mr. Doyle resurfaced. It was only a matter of time before his paper sensationalized this for all the money it was worth.
"Honestly," Liza whispered while slicing into her breakfast sausage, "I wish we weren't leaving so dreadfully early. I've never seen such excitement in the city. Victoria's throwing a masked ball, encouraging boys to come as the Ripper. Tall, dark, and completely anonymous. It's terribly thrilling, wouldn't you agree?"
I stole a glance at my aunt, who was watching me with a quirked brow. This was a test of good manners. I smiled pleasantly.
"It certainly is terrible." "True. I don't care what people say of those women. No one deserves to be slain like that. You simply must stop whoever it is."
Liza stared off, then shook herself into the present.
"I'm going to miss you, cousin. Come and stay with us soon."
I smiled, realizing I couldn't wait to see Liza again. My cousin was smart, unabashedly feminine, and comfortable playing by her own version of society's rules. Her clever remarks and cheerful presence would be missed.
"That would be lovely. I will."
I took a sip of Earl Grey, my focus returning to the paper while my aunt and cousin chatted about yesterday's tea I'd missed. Either Blackburn had kept his promise to seek the editor out and run a copy of the Dear Boss letter, or Mr. Doyle had decided to do so himself. I didn't trust Blackburn anymore, so my faith lay with the editor releasing the details. I reread the letter, getting lost in the manic cursive of the killer's script. Thinking back on the murder scene, there was an eerie number of similarities. The postcard depicted on the same page was something new, however. As it was dated from the night before, it was clear the murderer only recently posted it. Wretched ideas had assaulted me last night with the growing list of suspects. I didn't know who was responsible, but some memory kept creeping up on me. Miss Emma Elizabeth Smith possibly knew her attackers. Could that be Uncle and Thomas? In Uncle's notes, she'd told investigators one assailant was a teenager. Uncle was betrothed to her, and clearly it ended in some manner in which she resorted to prostitution. If Thomas was in on it, it'd explain how the murders continued while Uncle was in the asylum. It also meant I'd been inadvertently working with Jack the Ripper and possibly falling under his spell myself. My stomach twisted. There had to be something else.
I thought of Thornley, recalling the day Thomas and I had learned of Uncle's connection to Miss Emma Elizabeth. Thomas's shock appeared genuine enough, but was it all a farce? Perhaps he was as talented at acting as he was at flipping his emotions on and off. If only my wretched heart could shut itself off from him completely. There was something even worse to consider. My father had connections to most of the victims. It was possible the opium addled his brain in some way, twisting his anguish over mother into something violent. But was my father truly capable of murder? I wanted to deny it, to scream at myself for thinking such an awful thing. But father did have a habit of becoming someone else whenever he was afraid, or under the influence of his precious tonic. If father really was innocent, then why did my heart sink at the thought? Then there was the matter of Blackburn. Did he work with father? Their association was hidden from my brother and me for God only knew how long. What else might they be keeping to themselves? The murders began again when father came home. I stopped my mind from wandering down that bleak alleyway. I turned my attention back to the postcard facsimile in the paper. It wasn't very long, but the message was as chilling as the first. The grammar was just as poor, but I had a suspicion it was all for show. The script Jack used was far too clean and careful to be written by someone lacking education. It was a poor attempt at hiding his status in the community. But which status? Doctor? Lord? Superintendent? Or brilliant pupil? I was not codding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit. Couldn't finish straight off. Ha! Not the time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper. The postcard was written in the same hand as the first letter, the loops too similar to be a coincidence. The front of the offending document held no greater clue than the one before it had. It was addressed to Central News Office, London City.
Good morning, Amelia, Liza. I believe your carriage is ready.
Father strode into the dining room with a paper of his own tucked under an arm, and concern set upon his face when his attention turned to me.
Filling your head with safe and appropriate things, or are you disobeying my wishes so soon, Audrey Rose?
I lifted my face and smiled, an action more akin to a sneer. I was unaware keeping abreast of the daily news was inappropriate. Perhaps I shall spend my time, and your money, on new corsets to bind my will from my lips, I said sweetly. Wearing something so constricting ought to tether my vocal cords nicely. Wouldn't you agree? Father's eyes flashed a warning, but he'd not find me cowering today. I would solve this Ripper case, even if it meant awakening the sleeping beast from within whomever it was resting. That same creature was scratching and howling for a chance to be set free from inside me. I promised it all in due time, placating it for the moment. Well then, Aunt Amelia stood, motioning for Liza to do the same. It's been such a lovely visit. Thank you for hosting us in your absence, dear brother. You must take some time away from town and breathe in our country air again soon. She turned her attention on me, lips pinched in scrutiny. Might do Audrey Rose a world of good, getting away from this madness for a bit.
Perhaps you're right.
Father opened his arms to his sister, embracing her quickly before she left the room. Liza ran over to where I was still sitting, leaned down and gathered me into an uncomfortable hug.
You must write to me. I want to hear more about Mr. Thomas Cresswell and everything regarding the infamous Jack the Ripper. Promise you will?
I promise.
Wonderful.
She kissed my cheek, then hugged my father before dashing into the corridor. I was sad to see her go. Father crossed the room and sat in his chair, ignoring me in a way that accentuated his displeasure with my behavior, which suited me fine. After Nathaniel had confessed the truth about our family's secrets, I could barely look at father. Mother was dying of scarlet fever, and father knew of her already weakened heart. He never should have allowed uncle to operate on her when her immune system was under such attack. He knew uncle had never been successful before. Though, I couldn't blame him for being desperate to save her. I did wonder why he'd waited so long to ask Uncle for help. I'd been under the false impression that Uncle had operated on her before she'd taken a turn for the worse. I let a sigh escape. Uncle should have known better. But how could he turn his brother away? Especially when Lord Wadsworth had finally broken down and asked for help. The tragedy of what led us here, to this broken shell of a family, was overwhelming. And I feared I'd be as consumed by grief as Father was if I thought too hard on the past. I received word Uncle was back home late last evening, so I'd stay with him and see what I could discover there. I opened my paper again, not caring what Father had to say about it.
Are you so keen to end up a wretch on the streets?
I took a sip of tea, relishing the bright taste of Earl Grey on my tongue. Father was playing a dangerous game and hadn't a clue. You'd know a thing or two about wretches on the street. He dropped his hands onto the table, knocking his flatware askance. His face was pale yet angry.
You will respect me in my own home.
I stood, revealing my all-black riding ensemble. I allowed a full 30 seconds to pass, letting Father take in my mannish attire, shock and disbelief filtering through his expression. I tugged my leather gloves on as violently as I could, then stared down my nose at him. Those who deserve respect are given it freely. If one must demand such a thing, he'll never truly command it. I am your daughter, not your horse, sir. I stepped closer, enjoying the way Father leaned away from me, as if he were just now discovering that a cat, while precious and cute, also had sharp claws. I'd rather be a lowly wretch on the streets than live in a house full of cages. Do not lecture me on propriety when it's a virtue you so grossly lack. Without waiting for a response, I swept from the room with nothing but the sound of my heels ringing out against the silence. There would be no skirts or bustles to wrangle with any more. I was through with things confining me. Uncle's laboratory was a wreck, much like the man who resided there. Papers were scattered about, tables and chairs upturned, and servants were nervously cleaning on all fours, their attention flitting between their work and Uncle's never-ending tirade. Whether he was upset because his precious work had been tampered with, or because he'd come close to being caught for his crimes, I couldn't tell. But I was not leaving here without finding out. I'd never seen him in such a state. Police brought everything back from the evidence chambers when he was released from Bedlam, but threw it back in the laboratory without a care. It seemed Blackburn was no longer interested in winning my affections.
What miserable fiends!
Another crash reverberated in the small room off the main lab.
Years and years of documentation, gone! I've got half a mind to set Scotland Yard ablaze. What sort of animals do they hire?
Thomas entered the room, taking stock of the mess. He righted a chair, then folded himself into it, annoyance scrawled over his features. I studiously ignored him, and he responded in kind. Clearly he was still put off by our argument. Or maybe he felt my suspicion taking form and pointing a finger toward him. Uncle didn't remember much from his time in the asylum. The drugs proved too strong for his mind to battle, or so he claimed. He didn't recall mumbling his name repeatedly, or any revelation that might have stepped forth from the darkness.
"Don't just sit there,"
Uncle bellowed, tossing a handful of papers in Thomas's face.
"Fix this! Fix this whole bloody mess! I cannot function like this!"
Unable to watch the madness continue, I slowly approached Uncle with my hands up, as if he were a dog driven mad and cornered. I imagined his nerves were frayed, as the tonic they'd given him left his body. Uncle's occasional outbursts were never so loud or disorganized. "Perhaps," I motioned around the room, "we should wait upstairs while the maids tend to this." Uncle Jonathan looked ready to quarrel, but I'd have none of that. My new lack of tolerance extended to all Wadsworth males. Even if he proved innocent of the Ripper murders, Uncle had other things to answer for. I pointed at the door, leaving no room for argument. Maybe it was my new attire, or the stern set to my jaw, but the fight left Uncle rather quickly. He sighed, his shoulders slumping with defeat or relief, as he tromped up the stairs.
We settled in the drawing room with cups of tea and pleasant music spilling from a steam-powered machine in the corner. Thomas sat across from me, arms crossed and jaw set. My pulse spiked as his eyes met mine and sent sparks through my body. I longed to yell at him, demanding to know why he kept things from me, but bit my tongue. Now wasn't the time. Next order of business was more difficult to bridge. There was a river of lies and deceit that needed to be crossed in a short amount of time. I looked at my uncle. He'd been raging and throwing things since I walked in until this very instant. Even now his eyes were slightly glazed over, seeing some wretched thing no one else could. New anger burned quietly under my skin. I hated what Blackburn had done to him. I went to bury my hands in my skirts, then stopped, remembering I had no skirts to hide in. I know what happened with Thomas's mother. Thomas froze, teacup halfway to his lips, eyes wide. I turned my attention on Uncle. The fog surrounding him instantly dissipated, replaced by hardness I'd never really seen in him before.
What are you getting at?
I met his furious gaze dead on. After she died, you and Thomas began working together, performing secret experiments. Thomas leaned forward, nearly toppling out of his seat, his hawk attention homing in on Uncle's response. If only I could decipher his actions. Uncle laughed incredulously when he saw the seriousness in my face.
What does it matter if we did? We haven't performed a surgery in nearly a year. None of this relates to our Ripper. Some ghosts should remain good and buried, niece.
And some ghosts come back to haunt us, Uncle. Like Miss Emma Elizabeth Smith. Uncle Jonathan's expression was as dark as my father's, and I feared he'd send me away for intruding on his memories. When he sat back, stubbornly crossing his arms over his chest and sealing his lips, Thomas spoke up.
I see. You ought to just tell her. You don't see anything, boy,
Uncle spat.
You'd be wise keeping it that way.
I walked across the room and slammed the door shut, shifting their attention to me. If it weren't necessary to this investigation, I'd leave you to your peace. As there's a madman on the loose, ripping women apart, and potentially trying to use their organs the way some in this room have done in the past, we do not have that luxury.
Technically, we've never tried using organs for anything, Thomas said, then shrugged. My mother was too ill for the procedure. We've tested smaller theories out, but as your uncle said, we haven't performed surgery in a year. And that was simply reattaching a severed finger if you desire the details.
And you thought it a fine idea to hide this from me?
We've been a bit preoccupied with hunting down a murderer, Wadsworth, Thomas said flatly. Pardon me for not discussing something I find difficult. Aside from Dr. Wadsworth and now yourself, I've not spoken of my mother to anyone since she died. Especially since my father felt it appropriate to remarry before her body was cool to the touch. And my stepmother cannot be bothered with children who are not her own.
I'm sorry, Thomas. He shrugged again and looked away. I sat on a velvet settee. I couldn't believe it. This was the reason Thomas was skilled at being emotionally distant. The root of his arrogance. Liza was right. It did cover pain. My heart raced. Part of me wanted to draw him into a hug and heal his wounds, and part of me wished to ferret out all his secrets and piece the puzzle of him together this instant. But there was the matter of Uncle and his connection to Miss Emma Elizabeth that took precedence. With great effort, I faced Uncle. I need to know what happened with your former betrothed. I could see the gears working in his mind as he tried to avoid telling me the story. Please, tell me what became of Emma Elizabeth Smith. Uncle tossed his hands in the air.
Seems I know less than you.
Indulge me, then.
Oh, fine. She made me choose, her or science. When I refused, she severed all connection, saying she'd end up penniless before condoning such blasphemous work.
Uncle put his head in his hands, clearly thinking of his former love, was taking a toll on his already fragile state.
A steely determination I was very familiar with seemed to coat his bones then, rejuvenating him within the next breath. After all, this was the man who taught his students how to divorce themselves from the human aspect of something awful, and to charge ahead and seek out the facts without emotions blinding them. He sat up straighter, doling out facts one after the other.
Emma could have carried on with her life, but she chose not to. Said she wanted me to hurt as much as possible. Thought it had forced me into relenting.
He shook his head.
Last I'd heard, she rented a room in the East End, refusing to take money from her family. Rumors started, as they have a way of doing, that she was selling herself to afford lodging.
Uncle removed his glasses and wiped imaginary smudges from them. I couldn't imagine what his emotions must be like. He dropped his hands into his lap.
I didn't have the heart to find out if that was true. I pushed her from my mind, getting lost in my work, where I've happily lived out my days the last several years.
What happened the night you saw her body? I asked quietly. Does it remind you of the recent killings at all? Uncle jerked his head back, looking startled before twisting his moustache. He took a moment, flipping through the notes of his mind.
I suppose she could be one of the Ripper's victims.
Uncle crushed the leather case he kept his glasses in, his knuckles turning white as bone. When he spoke, it was through gritted teeth.
I must return to work.
Thomas arched a brow, then set his attention on me. It seemed there were still secrets left to be revealed. I couldn't tell if he was in on them or not, but was determined to find out.
Chapter 23 The Conjurer's Art. Little Ilford Cemetery, London, 8th October, 1888. Two stone dragons stood sentinel over our carriage as it moved across cobblestones and through the largest of three ogival archways leading into Little Ilford Cemetery. A heavy mist shrouded a small group of mourners standing around the freshly dug grave of Miss Catherine Eddowes, the slain woman I'd inspected during the double event, blanketing them from the harshness of the day. Winter was biting at autumn's toes, reminding the milder season it'd be here soon. As a sign of respect for the deceased, I'd worn a proper gown instead of the riding habit and breeches I'd recently adopted as my ensemble of choice. My simple black dress was eerily similar to what I'd worn the night of Miss Annie Chapman's murder. I hoped it wasn't a prediction of worse things to come. I felt a strange connection to Catherine, perhaps because I'd knelt over her body and examined the scene where she'd been found. Papers described her as jolly when sober, singing a tune for anyone who'd listen. The night she was murdered, she'd been drunk, lying in the street before being detained by police until shortly after 1 in the morning. Ripper found her not long after that, silencing her songs forever. Uncle stayed at his laboratory, speaking with detective inspectors about the second victim of that bloody night, ushering Thomas and me off in his carriage to glean what we could from Miss Catherine's funeral attendees. He believed killers often visited the sites of their destruction or involved themselves in cases, though like most of his notions, it couldn't be proven. Detective inspectors didn't spend much time convincing Uncle his expertise was essential to solving the case. A little ego-stroking on the part of the upper echelons of Scotland Yard went a long way to assuage Uncle's damaged pride. I couldn't stop stealing glances at Thomas, wondering if the very monster I was hunting was standing beside me. Though his story of his mother's death and father's near-immediate remarriage tugged at me emotionally, perhaps that was his intention. For now, I'd watch him, but act as if all was well between us. Thomas held an umbrella over our heads, his attention focused on everyone in the gathering. There weren't many mourners, and to be honest, none of them appeared the least bit suspicious, except for one bearded man who tossed stares over his shoulder at us. Something about him set caution humming through my veins.
"Dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return," the priest quoted from the Book of Genesis, holding his arms skyward. "May your soul rest more peacefully than the manner in which you left us, beloved sister."
The handful of people murmured a collective amen before dispersing from the plot. Dreary weather kept their sadness at arm's length, and their prayers for the dead short. Moments later the sky opened up and rain flowed freely, forcing Thomas to stand a bit closer with the umbrella. Or perhaps he was using it as an excuse. He'd been hovering around me as if I were the sun his universe revolved around, ever since he'd let me past one of his many emotional walls. Something to ponder another day. I walked over to the makeshift grave marker, kneeling to run my gloved fingertips across the rough wooden cross, feeling a wave of sadness for a woman I didn't even know. The City of London pulled together, giving her a proper burial and grave. People were always providing in death what they would not do in life, it seemed.
Audrey Rose.
Thomas cleared his throat, and I glanced up, spotting the bearded man lingering a few paces off, looking torn between approaching us and fading into the desolate grey morning. Unable to shake the feeling he had something important to impart to us, I motioned for Thomas to follow me. If he won't come to us, I said over my shoulder, we'll bring ourselves to him. I stopped before him, extending my hand. Good morning. My name is...
Miss Audrey Rose Wadsworth, daughter of Melina and... What's that?
He asked an invisible person to his left. Thomas and I exchanged baffled looks. Clearly he was unbalanced, speaking to air. But there was something about him knowing my mother's name that unnerved me. He nodded to something we still couldn't see.
Ah, yes, daughter of Melina and Edmund. Your mother says you're welcome to the necklace in the photograph. The heart-shaped locket, I believe.
Yes, yes, he said, nodding again. That's right, the one you admired in your father's study.
It's being used as a bookmark of sorts.
He paused, squinting at nothing. My heart was very near breaking its way out of my body. Thomas grabbed my arm, steadying me as I swayed on my feet. How could this man possibly know these things? Memories of sneaking into father's study and looking upon the photograph of mother assaulted my senses. I'd been admiring that locket, wondering where it was hidden. No one knew about that. I barely even recalled it myself. I took a wavering step back, frightened yet not quite believing this was not some act of deceit, some illusionist's manipulation of the truth. I'd read reports in papers of charlatans and tricksters, unscrupulous fakers making profit by showing audiences what they wanted to believe. There was some kind of smoke and mirrors game being played, and I'd have none of it. How do you know these things? I demanded, regaining my composure. Calming my still racing heart, I sought to apply logic to the situation. This man must surely be a skilled liar. He did some form of research, then made educated guesses. Essentially, the same principle Thomas used while deducing the obvious. Heart-shaped lockets were popular. Practically every woman in London owned one. It was an educated guess, nothing more. For all I knew, the necklace was sitting in a forbidden jewelry box, not being used as an expensive bookmark. I wouldn't be surprised if he worked for some despicable newspaper. Perhaps Mr. Doyle had sent him to spy on us, desperate to ferret out another story.
Easy there, Wadsworth,
Thomas said, loud enough for only me to hear.
If you shake any harder, I'm afraid you might take flight, killing us in the process. While I do not fear death, it might prove a bit tedious after a while. All that heavenly singing would become rather grating, don't you agree?
I drew in a slow, steady breath. He was right. Getting agitated wouldn't make this situation better. I allowed myself to calm down before turning my glower back on this liar. He held his hands up as if he meant no harm, except the harm had already been done.
Let me begin again, Miss Wadsworth. I often forget how odd I must seem to non-seers.
He extended his hand, waiting for mine to meet his. Reluctantly, I allowed him to kiss my gloved knuckles before sticking my hands back at my sides.
My name is Robert James Lees. I'm a medium. I communicate with spirits who've passed on. I'm also a spiritualist preacher.
Oh, good.
Thomas wiped his brow in a gesture of relief.
And here I thought you were simply insane. This'll be much more fun.
I fought a smile as the spiritualist stuttered over his next words.
Yes, Yes, well, all right then. As I was saying, I speak with the dearly departed, and the spirit of Miss Eddowes sought me out almost every night this week, starting from the night she was slain, he said. My spirit guides told me I'd find someone here who could help stop Jack the Ripper once and for all. I kept getting drawn to you, miss. That's when your mother came through.
I listened with the practiced ear of a skeptic. My mind was very much immersed in science, not religious fads and notions of speaking with the dead. Mr. Lees exhaled, nodding to that same unseen force again.
So I thought. I've got it on good authority, you're unbelieving.
He held his hand up when I opened my mouth to argue.
It's something I contend with most every day of my life. My path isn't an easy one, but I'll not stop my journey. If you'd like to accompany me to my parlor, I'll do a proper conjuring for you.
Part of me wanted to say yes. Sensing my wavering, he continued with his sale.
Take what you will from our session, leaving anything which isn't useful behind. All I ask is a few minutes of your time, Miss Wadsworth, he said. Nothing more. Very best you'll walk away with information about the killer. At the very least, an entertaining story to share with your friends later.
He offered a hard bargain when he put it into those terms.
If you have information on Jack the Ripper, Thomas asked, holding the umbrella steady, why haven't you gone straight to Scotland Yard?
I studied Thomas. His question certainly seemed genuine. Unless he was displacing suspicion. Mr. Lees smiled ruefully.
They've declined my services on more than one occasion, he said. It's easier thinking me mad than seriously regarding any clues I might unearth.
I tapped my fingers on my arms, contemplating his offer. The first part about being a good scientist was remaining open to studying all variables, even ones we don't necessarily understand. How little my mind would be if I dismissed a possibility without investigating it, simply because it didn't fit into a preconceived notion. No advances would ever be made. Scotland Yard was foolish to turn him away. There was the considerable chance he was a fraud, but even the tiniest percentage he could be right should be enough to at least listen to him. I knew the hope of speaking with Mother was entering both my thoughts and heart, clouding my judgment. Internally, I fought myself. Perhaps one day I'd seek Mr. Lees out when I was ready to confront that emotional mess. Now, with Thomas present, I needed to keep a clear focus. I took a deep breath, knowing this might perfectly well be a giant waste of time, but not caring. If I had to wave chicken feet at every raven I saw during the full moon to stop this murderer and avenge all the women who were tortured, I'd do it. Plus, one way or another, maybe it would remove any lingering doubt I had about Thomas. Very well, then, I said. Dazzle us with your conjuring arts, Mr. Lees. Thomas threw an impatient glance at me from across the tiny, battered table in Mr. Lees' seance parlor. His leg bouncing so fast the feather-light table vibrated with his every jitter. The pinch-lipped look I returned to him was laced with unspoken threat. I learned something useful from Aunt Amelia, after all. Thomas stilled his legs before rapping a jittery beat against his arms. Honestly, he acted as if I were dragging him through the streets across a bed of nails during a winter storm. The mark of a young man with more secrets? Or simply a bored one? If Mr. Lees was authentic, I might have an answer shortly. I scanned our surroundings, doing my best to retain an impassive facade, but it was hard. Grey light filtered in through musty curtains, lighting on every speck of dust in the small flat, causing my nose to itch. Instruments used for speaking with spirits were jumbled in the corners and poked out of cabinets, and dust covered most every surface. A little house cleaning would go a long way. Perhaps Mr. Lees would have more customers if he'd tidied up a bit. I supposed, however, one didn't have much time for cleaning when one was speaking with the dead at all hours of the day and night. If his abilities were real, I likened it to being stuck at a party 24 hours a day. The thought of having to listen to someone speak that long was utterly dreadful. my attention snagged on a horn-shaped tube resting atop a rickety-looking cabinet. It was one of the few items in the room that appeared shiny and new.
"That's a spirit trumpet,"
Mr. Lee said, jerking his chin toward the contraption.
"It amplifies whispers of the spirits. Truthfully, I haven't had any luck with it, but it's all the rage these days. Figured I'd give it a whirl. And that's a spirit slate."
The so-called spirit slate was nothing more than two chalkboards tied together with a bit of string. I assumed it was another tool the dead could use for communicating with the living. People wanted to be entertained by gadgets and gimmicks, it seemed, as much as they wanted to speak with their loved ones. A haunted atmosphere was ripe for conversation starters amongst the wealthy, who knew nothing of poverty. Thomas coughed a laugh away, drawing my attention to him. He subtly pointed to my leg, bouncing its own anxious beat against the table, then coughed harder at my dark look. I was glad he was so amused. That made one of us.
"Right then."
Mr. Lees situated himself in the middle.
"I'll ask the two of you to place your hands on the table, like so."
He demonstrated by placing his large palms face down, thumbs touching at their tips.
"Spread your fingers apart so your pinky fingers touch your neighbors on either side." "Excellent, that's perfect. Now, close your eyes and clear your minds."
It was a good thing the table was so small, else we'd never be able to reach one another's hands comfortably. Thomas's pinky kept twitching away from mine, so I quietly shifted my foot under the table and gave him a little kick. Before he could retaliate, Mr. Lees closed his eyes, letting loose a deep sigh. "Focus," I scolded myself. If I was going to do this sitting, I'd do it 100%.
"I ask that my spirit guides step forth, aiding me on this spiritual journey through the afterlife. Anyone with a connection to either Thomas or Audrey Rose may present themselves now."
I peeked through slitted lashes. Thomas was being a good sport, sitting with his eyes closed and his back straight as a walking stick. Mr. Lees looked as if he was sleeping while sitting upright. His eyes fluttered beneath his lids, his whiskers and beard twitching to some rhythmic beat only he could hear. I stared at the little lines around his eyes. He couldn't have been more than 40, but looked as if he'd seen as much as someone twice his age. His hair was grey at the edges, receding like the ocean sweeping away from the shore of his forehead. He inhaled deeply, his facial features stilling.
"Identify yourself, spirit."
I latched my attention onto Thomas again, but he didn't crack a smile or an eyelid, politely playing along with our ghost divining host. He certainly wasn't acting nervous now. I couldn't stop myself from simultaneously hoping and dreading another encounter with my mother so soon, if his opening in the graveyard were to be believed that was. Mr. Lees nodded.
"We welcome you, Miss Eddowes."
He paused, giving himself time to think of a fabrication or to listen to the spirit, his face twisted in concentration.
"Yes. Yes. I'll tell her now."
"Oh good, we'll get right to it then. How silly." He shifted in his chair, never breaking contact with either of our hands.
"Miss Eddowes says you were present the day her body was discovered. She claims you were accompanied by a man with pale hair."
My breath caught, hope of hearing from Mother momentarily set aside. Could it be true? Could Miss Catherine Eddowes be speaking through this stout, untidy man? This was all very strange, but I didn't necessarily believe one second of it. Anyone who was at the crime scene that morning would have seen me walking with Superintendent Blackburn. Not knowing proper protocol for this type of situation, I whispered, "That's true." I glanced at Thomas, but he was still sitting quietly, eyes shut. His mouth, however, was now pressed into a tight line. I turned my attention back on our spiritualist.
"Aha,"
Mr. Lees said, his tone full of understanding. I wasn't sure if he was addressing me or the supposed spirit hovering about, so I waited with my lips sealed together.
"Miss Eddowes says
to pass along this message to aid you in believing. She says, there's an identifying mark on her body, and you'll know straight away what she's speaking of.
The urge to yank my hands back and leave this den of lies plagued me for a few beats. I knew precisely what she was talking about. There was a small tattoo on her left forearm that had the initials TC. That was hardly a secret. Again, anyone could have seen her arm in passing. I sighed, disappointed this turned out to be an act of folly. Before I said a word or broke contact with Thomas or Mr. Lees, he hurriedly continued.
She said Jack was there that day as well, that he'd seen you.
He closed his mouth, nodding again, as if he were an interpreter passing a message along from a foreign speaker.
He got close to you. Even spoke with you. You were angry with him.
Mr. Lees rocked in his chair, his closed eyes moving like confused pigeons squabbling back and forth in front of a park bench. A deep, cold fear wound itself around my limbs, strangling reason from my brain. The only people I'd been angry with were Superintendent Blackburn and my father. Uncle had still been in the asylum, and Thomas and I were not speaking. If this man was truly communing with the dead, that cleared them of lingering suspicion. But Father and Blackburn? Unwilling to hear more, I drew my hand away, but Thomas reached for it, placing it next to his. His encouraging look said we would see this through together, quieting me for the moment. Our medium rocked in his seat, his movements coming faster and sharper. The wood creaked a panicked beat, spurring my own pulse into a chaotic rhythm. Mr. Lees stood so abruptly the chair he'd been sitting on crashed to the floor. It took several seconds for him to reorient himself, and when his eyes cleared, he stared at me as if I'd transformed into Satan himself.
"Mr. Lees, are you going to share what's troubling you with us?" Thomas said. "Or are you keeping what the spirits said to yourself?"
Mr. Lees trembled, shaking his head to clear away whatever he'd heard and seen. When he finally spoke, his tone was as ominous as his words.
"Leave London at once, Miss Wadsworth. I was mistaken. I cannot help you. Go!"
he bellowed, startling us. He faced Thomas.
"You must keep her safe. She's been marked for death."
Thomas narrowed his eyes.
"If this is some trick..." "Leave! Leave now, before it's too late!"
Mr. Lees ushered us to the door, tossing me my coat as if it were on fire.
"Jack craves your blood, Miss Wadsworth. God be with you."
Chapter 24. From Hell. Dr. Jonathan Wadsworth's Library, Highgate, 16th October, 1888.
"I see you've thrown yourself another pity party," Thomas said, breezing into Uncle's darkened library.
Lifting my head from my book, I noticed his clothing was exceptionally stylish for an afternoon apprenticing with cadavers. His finely stitched jacket fit perfectly to his frame. He caught me inspecting it and grinned.
"You've yet to send out invitations, Wadsworth. Rather rude, don't you think?"
I ignored both him and his remark, though I knew he was trying to make light of our situation. 8 days had come and gone since we'd spoken with Mr. Lees, and it had been even longer since I'd last seen my father. While I couldn't rely on Mr. Lees' spirit testimony alone, Thomas was moving further down the suspect list every day. He pored over notes and details day and night. I didn't think the stress he tried hiding was an act. Thomas wanted this case solved as badly as I did. During one particularly troubling evening, I shared my fears regarding my father with him. He'd opened his mouth, then shut it. And that was the end of that. His reaction was less than comforting. Staying true to his word, Father didn't seek me out, remaining indifferent to my whereabouts. It was so unlike him, letting me out of his sight for days on end. But he'd become a stranger to me, and I couldn't predict his next moves. I hated thinking or admitting it, but he fit several of Jack the Ripper's emerging characteristics. He'd been present for each crime,
and absent when Jack had seemingly disappeared for those 3.5 weeks in September. Much as I wanted his opinion, I kept these dark speculations from Nathaniel. Worrying him was unnecessary until I had absolute proof Father was, indeed,